I know why people look at industrial controllers and say, well, this looks like, I mean, I've once had the analogy, it looks a bit like if you have a PS5 and then you put a Game Boy next to it. That's what a PSC looks like. It looks old-fashioned, but then again, it has to work in rough operational conditions. There's vibration, there is dust, there is heat, there's everything that IT doesn't love, right? So, and these things still work for 20 years and counting.
Welcome back to another episode of Victor. Today, we got to do an episode on CRA, or EU Cyber Resilience Act. And I thought, why not bring on a proper expert? I've talked a lot about CRA over the last year on the show, but I want to bring on a real expert. So today, I'm with me, Sarah Flux. Welcome, Sarah.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Sarah, you are definitely an authority and you've been involved in CRA for quite some time. But before we dive into CRA and all the implications that it has to come with it for people who are selling into the European market, maybe let's start by giving people some backstory about yourself. You've been in the tech world and kind of around this world for a while. So give people a kind of a backstory so we can kind of shape the conversation, understand the context of where you're coming from.
Okay. Well, I work in OT cybersecurity, so my background really is in engineering, not in cybersecurity. I'm one of the persons that were first in engineering and then kind of took the direction into cyber, as we say nowadays. So I work for a company. I'm a CTO of a company who does consulting in the OT cybersecurity space. And we, as the CTO, I'm responsible for methodologies and for all the things that we do that make sure that we keep at the bleeding edge of what's going on in OT cybersecurity. And that's why I've always been involved in standardization, because that plays a big role in cybersecurity, as we all know, and also in regulation, because it's just one of our driving factors. And I did a PhD in security by design for OT, and during that time, that was exactly the time when CRA first came up. So that's when I kind of stumbled upon CRA. I write a monthly newsletter, and that's always my time to read up on all the things that sound interesting. And back in 2022, I think nobody talked about CRA yet, and just the draft came up, and I read through this and really was drawn into that, because I was like, oh wow, this is going to be a really big thing. Yeah. Like, it's going to make a difference. And it's exactly the thing that I'm researching currently in my PhD. So naturally, I was intrigued. Yeah, that's how I came to CRA. And this year, I was selected to be on the CRA expert group for the EU Commission. And that, of course, is great, because you get a close up on all the debates that are going on around the Cyber Resilience Act.
There's a lot to unpack there, but I think people who have been kind of, at least, well, I guess maybe for people who are not familiar with the OT world, maybe we'll start by there. Like, what's OT? I mean, people come, yeah. I guess most of my audience watching, they're from the IT, cybersecurity space. OT, kind of a tangential industry with some overlap. So maybe we can start unpacking that before we dive into the all.
Yeah,
that.
Absolutely. I have sympathy for everybody who doesn't know what OT is. So that's fine. When I started out in OT, OT wasn't even a word. So it's right. Kind of new. And people that work in OT, that other people from the outside call as working in OT, don't see themselves as working in OT, interestingly. So what's OT? OT, so the official translation is operation technology. I also like to refer to it as the other technologies. So everything that's not IT. So it's basically, and that's also how it came about. It is an IT people term for this strange other technology that somehow also is our networks. And it's basically all the kind of electronic technology that operates some kind of physical process. So an industrial plant or a wastewater plant or a production plant or our energy grid, or all these things are operated by OT, so by controllers, microcontrollers, programmable logic controllers or control systems, and all these things that belong to that. So that's OT.
And how, I guess there is a, if, I guess if you do a Venn diagram there, you have industrial IoT, which is kind of like a, which moves somewhat into that space as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
I guess it's murky where things belong, I suppose. I guess it's the
yeah, absolutely. And I'm not a fan of really getting too much caught up in definitions on what belongs to OT and what doesn't, because it doesn't really help.
Yeah. And your PhD being secure by design in this OT world, or this people who have had at least a little bit of exposure to this world, they usually come away screaming because they realize that a lot of them are not very secure. Secure at very best is an afterthought, if it's a thought at all. How do you end up in that world at all? Because it's almost, CRA, as we will speak about in a moment, will change this hopefully. But what's your exposure in that world? Like, how do you get it drawn into that in the first place?
You mean security by design in general, OT?
No, security by design in the OT world, I guess, because that's it feels like security by design is the leading edge in the cybersecurity space in general.
That's right.
The OT world is 30 years behind in many ways. So merging these polar
opposites. That's a very IT person thing to say, So it's been one of the long conversations of IT people always saying, well, if OT could just do things like we've been doing then for 30 years, they would be fine. And the thing is, it doesn't work that way. So, and at the same time, OT is ahead in other ways. So it's like, it's a really specific kind of technology that is really good at specifically what it does. And it also, if it's from an engineer's perspective, that's always what bothered me about IT when I first looked into IT. I was responsible for security engineering when I started out in consulting. And so I sat down and said, okay, what is security engineering? Mm. And then I found out that IT people really have a very broad understanding of what counts as engineering. So I'm a mechanical engineer and then a process engineer. So when I think about engineering, I think about there's a problem. We've got to do a drawing. We've got a diagram. We've got a methodology to solve this. We do some calculations and then we've got a couple of options how to solve this. And then we engineer a solution. And in IT, it's more or less, well, here's your list of best practices. And you choose one, and then that's engineering. And that's kind of, for an OT person, that's not how that works. So that feels like crystal ball looking, but not like engineering. It feels like witchcraft, but not like engineering. And that really, I think that is just the first difference that people need to understand when they say, oh, if OT could just do things the same way like we did. No, they can't, because the things that are OT in there, they are surrounded by a lot of more technology. And if you fuck something up there, then really you could have a nuclear power plant blowing up, or you could have people's lives injured. So they are a lot more conservative about how things are and what the controllers can do and what the systems can do. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. And also, they're very good at staying focused on the essential functionality of a certain component, and not having everything around there just because you can. And I think these are things, so fundamental differences that people really need to understand before they judge about the other disciplines. So it's the same for OT. So they also like to sneer at IT and say, well, that's not really engineering. It's not really that they change everything every day, and it's not made for decades. It's going to be exchanged in 5 years anyway. So it helps if you have a bit more respect from both sides towards the other side.
That's a very fair point. I mean, I think you said something here which is very interesting to me, which is the lifespan, the life cycle, which is very, like, if you're talking about like cloud engineering or whatever you want to call it these days, right? Like, that operates in weeks, months, years, maybe, but it's not, you're not thinking that long term at all. Like, it's kind of almost going back to the mainframe world analogy, right? Like, they were built for the long run. Cloud workloads are ephemeral and they will be replaced shortly, right? So this is really interesting, particularly if you talk about maintainability for a long time, right? Zero trust and all these concepts, they talk a lot about like how you are going to patch vulnerabilities and how you got to do life cycle management of these. Like, those concepts are very different in the OT world, right? How you do, like, package managers are not necessarily a thing at all in that world, right?
So how, well, software how... works differently in that world
exactly.
And it's in every plant, in every industrial plant, when you work around, you find at least one person that says, look, and this PLC here that has been running for 20 years without a single day of downtime. Imagine that in IT. I mean, that's a superpower. Imagine we could do that in IT. And before IT managed to do that, I don't want to get advice from IT how to do resilient systems, you know, because I get it. I know why people look at industrial controllers and say, well, this looks like, I mean, I've once at the analogy, it looks a bit like if you have a PS5 and then you put a Game Boy next to it. What a PLC looks like. It looks old-fashioned, but then again, it has to work in rough operational conditions. There's vibration, there is dust, there is heat, there's everything that IT doesn't love, right? So, and these things still work for 20 years and counting.
Sorry. I was just going to say, like, how do you view, I mean, OTA being something that is kind of expected in the modern era of IoT and IIoT, right? That's not necessarily something that fits in traditional worldviews from OT, right? Doing like pushing OTA updates over every few days or months or weeks or so. How does that kind of narrative fit into traditional OT in your world? Because I guess that's the segue into CRA, which is very tightly controlled, that you must be able to do certain things like this, right?
Yeah, right. And that's actually a hard thing to do for many, many people in OT, because it's not like, it's pretty clear that you can't just restart a nuclear power plant every 2 days. It doesn't work. So if there is a Windows patch day and then next week there's the next Windows patch day, then that's something that drives engineers crazy in plants like that. But still, of course, there is this thing like IT and OT convergence. Of course, there is more and more commercial off-the-shelf technology and more normal IT technology being used in OT as well. I mean, at the end of the day, most control system servers are run on Windows. It's not like we're immune against any of these things. In patching in general needs a different approach in OT, because oftentimes you lose warranties or liabilities if you just patch control systems, for example. You can't just put a patch on there, because then the control system vendor says, okay, I'm out, no liability anymore taken because you've changed the system. Sometimes these systems have certifications. So for example, for safety certifications. So there really comes there's a TÜV or someone else, so any kind of company who really certifies the software as is, and you're not allowed to change a bit about that, because otherwise you lose certification, and regaining certification is a process that can take months. So just, it's not as easy as saying, okay, well then just deploy that patch and then you're good to go. And that's also one of the problems that many manufacturers in the industrial sector see currently when they look at CRA and say, okay, we're supposed to deliver products without exploitable vulnerabilities and also patch them immediately when they come up. That's actually a problem, because we can't just take everything out of the market. And also it's a problem for operators. We can't just always have three-month standstills just because there's a patch and then we need to recertify, for example.
Yeah, because it's complete polar opposite needs, right? Because, I mean, modern software kind of assumes that you can do this stuff, but then there are...
That's right,
You kind of... In particular, if you're using a bad example, like the JavaScript world, where they have a 6-month life cycle, then like there's a new library.
Isn't it kind of weird that we accept it as normal that you need to update software like 5 times a day? I mean,
it's kind of crazy. You're absolutely right. But we've just become normal.
How has that become normal? I mean, how is that supposed to be good engineering? But it is the way the things work in IT. That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but I guess what I'm saying is, like, with looming pressure to be able to conduct these updates, there are completely bipolar requirements, and the suppliers or the manufacturer of these devices, they're between a rock and hard place, right? Because on the one hand, they need to have all these strict compliance regulations from that they cannot change things, and simultaneously they have to change things. It must be, that's very different from say software, which is like updating.
It is done. Absolutely, yeah. And the approach that's very likely going to be taken, that's also the approach that already is being taken towards patch management and OT, that you just don't have this patch everything as soon as possible approach, but you do a lot more of down-to-earth prioritization of, okay, what really needs to be patched and what really is a risk, because the risk on the other side, so there's always the risk for don't patch is kind of clear because then you have the vulnerability, but in OT there's also a large risk of patch because if you patch, there's cost, because sometimes there needs to be downtime for these patches, and there's also a risk of things not working. And then patches need to be rolled back and things like that. So that's just a risk equation that goes a lot more towards not patch. If in doubt, not don't patch, or have kind of compensating measures, or also, and that's also how things work in CRA. For some systems, you just limit where they can be operated, what their intended purpose is. So I can say, okay, this is something that absolutely cannot be connected to the internet, for example. And then you can afford to not patch as fast as you would for other systems, for example.
Yeah, because I mean, it's not like to use a cloud analysis, you don't have a staging nuclear facility where you can just run your tests and then you...
Right. So if you blow that up, then it doesn't matter that much. Yeah.
Exactly,
things just don't work that way in OT. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's very different the worlds. But all right. So we mentioned our CRA multiple times, and maybe you being kind of much more of a domain expert than myself in this domain, what's a CRA? Let's give people, assume people do not know what it is. Assume that you're a company selling in hardware into European market and you have never heard of this, which I literally had a conversation last week, with a vendor that have no idea about this stuff. And a lot of people still, even though ratification is starting next year, are very unaware what this even means to them, right? So let's start there. You're a vendor selling into the European market. What do you need to know? Like, explain it, as I know nothing about this.
I think the most important thing to mention is that there are certain cybersecurity requirements, and if you don't meet them, then you won't be able to sell your product anymore into the European Union. And that's also the first thing that especially companies that are not from the European Union really have to sink in a bit and to swallow, because say, well, how can they even prohibit me from selling products? But yes, they can, and they can based on cybersecurity, and that indeed is something very new. I think that's indeed something unique globally. I'm not aware of any other region who has such strict cybersecurity requirements for products that even can prevent people from placing the product on the market. And I like to explain it best, I think, compared to other products, because it's essentially in the European Union, we've had the very same mechanisms for a long time for other products. It's always been for safety reasons. So it's always when a product is at risk, can put its buyer or its user at risk, then there are some, there is a CE marking. Mm-hmm. It stands for Conformity European. So for European conformity. That's a C and a E, and I've probably seen that before. And that's, for example, it's on sunglasses. So if you buy sunglasses, then of course there needs to be proper UV protection, because otherwise people put them on, and that if they don't have the protection, they assume they have the protection, then they can hurt their eyes. So that's why there is a CE marking on these sunglasses. And the CE marking means that manufacturers pledge to be in conformity with the relevant European regulations for this type of product. And what's new about CRA now is that really such a CE marking gets applied on pretty much everything you have on your desk, so on every digital product, so from smartphones and laptops and pretty much everything.
My Bluetooth, so like even that would...
Well then, maybe that as well, yeah. So there's going to be a CE marking on that, and the CE marking is going to mean it's in conformity with all the European Union regulation, including the Cyber Resilience Act.
So you spend a lot of time doing advisory work with companies and in your consulting work. You now need to conform, so that's clear. But what does that actually mean? If you're selling, the terminology is device, but I'm forgetting
a product with digital elements.
That's exactly it. You're selling a product with digital elements, and you're going into the European market. You have now assessed that I can't ignore the European market for strategic reasons or whatnot, right? And you're now going to sell it. All right, where do I start to even become compliant as a vendor?
Yeah, so obviously the first step is, as a vendor, see which of your products actually need to be compliant. There are some categories of important and critical products that have some stricter, not requirements, but stricter requirements for proving the conformity. The requirements are the same for all. When you've done that, what you have is the basis of the CRA. If you only want to read two pages of the CRA, take Annex 1, because that's the essential requirements, and that's the requirements that actually you need to be in conformity with. So, and that's two parts. The first part is basically technical requirements. They're worded very broadly. So there are things like integrity protection, or make sure the personal data is protected. So nothing that comes as a surprise for a security person, to be honest. And then the second part is about vulnerability handling, because CRA, really a large part of CRA is about vulnerability handling. And that also makes it different from all the other product legislation we have in the European Union, because obviously, I mean, if a product, if you think about product safety, then you produce it in conformity with some kind of legislation and test this UV protection, for example, and then you're done, unless you find a mistake in your production and or something. But that's really not that often. But in cybersecurity, we have vulnerabilities that can come up any time, and that really makes CRA so different. And so the thing that think that's most maybe hardest for manufacturers to believe and also to meet is that they actually have to have a support period defined for the products that has to be at least 5 years, or as long as the product's lifespan is. And they have to deliver security updates for free during that lifespan. And that's a big one, of course, because...
Yeah, and there's a lot to unpack there, right? For the first one is 5 years, and that is, even if you have a product today with existing SKU and that's the place to the market, the clock, and this is where I've seen a lot of people confused about CRA, like when that 5 year time period starts. If I have a product that I've already had manufacturing and I'm placing that on the market today and I'm selling that today with an existing SKU, does the clock start from the first customer buys it? Does it start when I first started manufacturing? So like it's 3 years from that pair? Like, how does that actually clock work?
Yeah, the concept of placing on the market is a bit hard to grasp, also because it has a lot of legal deep dives you could do and say, okay, in that case. But generally, you can say placing on the market is when a manufacturer first sells that product to someone. It can be a distributor, it can be the end customer, but it is the first time it leaves the manufacturer's facilities, a contract assigned to sell the product to someone, whoever it is. And what's also important for the CRA to understand CRA is there's no such thing as a product type or anything. So the CRA always applies to each individual product. That also means if you buy a laptop, no, CRA doesn't apply now, but if you buy a laptop on the 1st of January 2028, then it has 5 years of support period, and that ends on the 1st of January 2033. And if you buy it 6 months later, then that laptop you buy 6 months later has a support period that ends 6 months later. So it's actually for every instance that's sold.
This is extremely complicated in supply chain, because... Yes. You as a manufacturer do not control your entire supply chain per se. You might have sold it to a distributor who sits on these for 3 years and then they finally sell them. But you as a manufacturer are still obligated to support it when it gets to the hand of the customer.
No, you're not. Because that could be impossible for manufacturers to control, as you say.
Right.
So you, as a manufacturer, you're obliged to support the product for the 5 years or whatever the support period is, starting when you sell it to the distributor. So if it sits as a distributor shelves for 5 years, then theoretically you could buy a product as an end customer that doesn't have any support anymore.
Right. So it's void and void as the clock starts when you ship it off to your distributor or your end customer, right. depending on that first.
Because otherwise there's no way for the manufacturers to know.
That was kind of my point, right? Because then you have essentially infinite life cycle for a given device, which is not realistic.
It's still complicated enough as is. Yes. So, because theoretically you have for a single product, you can have multiple, endlessly many different dates for end of support period. And I actually think there will be pragmatic ways how manufacturers deal with it. So when I discuss that, the most likely case is that I say, okay, we just have an end of support date. And the first product that we sell, if someone buys it earlier, then they just get longer support, but the guaranteed support is just 5 years. And then, so that you don't have to maintain multiple support end dates for the same type of product, but different instances, because you're getting crazy administrating that.
Exactly. And that's it gets really difficult. And also now, let's talk about what that actually means to make sure you provide security updates for all these devices that you send. Because we talk about vulnerabilities and patching all those things. It's not really a solved problem today to do, like, there's no unified way of doing software and security updates across products in the market, right? It varies a lot. Like the way you do that for a light bulb is very different than you do from a laptop, which is very different from a camera, right? What have you seen so far, like in terms of, are you expecting to see more involvement in that space? Because right now, like IoT is kind of very fragmented, to say the least, when it comes to OTA and updates. How do you expect this to kind of change the landscape, really? Because it does, you can't really expect people walk around with a USB stick and update things, right? That's not really...
Well, and then an OT. thing really is, CRA doesn't prescribe how updates are to be rolled out. So I know that in other legislations, I think also for automotive, there are requirements to do it over the air. There's no such requirement in the CRA. There is a requirement that you can do it, that you must be able to do it automatically. Mm-hmm. If technically feasible. and that's something that came in after a lot of industry feedback, and also that there must be a way to turn off the automatic updates. Because that, again, in OT really matters. And we have a lot of, so if you're looking at industrial manufacturers, so automatic updates are great for consumer devices, and having it turned on is great for consumer devices, unless the consumer chooses not to connect them to the internet, which is sometimes security advice. So then you have this conflicting advice of don't connect to the internet, but do enable the automatic updates, and then, that's a deadlock. Yeah. But for industrial manufacturers, oftentimes customers don't at all want automatic updates. So that's like the worst thing that can happen to them, because then we've talked about software not being changed and certifications, and doing that automatically is even worse. So we do have a lot of industrial manufacturers as customers who actually say the default for us is not doing it automatically, and we're putting in our user instructions information that we don't do it automatically because it doesn't make any sense. It would just increase risk and not lower risk.
Okay.
And then, yes, people walk in with USB sticks and update devices. That's how it works. And sometimes even in industrial space, sometimes even customers aren't even allowed or don't even know how to update these things themselves. They call any kind of contractor or service provider, and they walk in with the so-called USB stick and update the devices. So that is completely normal. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very different world.
It is a different world, yes.
Yeah.
It is.
I think it's hard not to kind of move on to S-bombs from here, I guess, which is the litmus test for if you know your software supply chain. I've had Alan Friedman on the show, I had Steve Springett on the show, and I had a bunch of people in the S-bomb world who've spoken about this. I guess if people really want to know about S-bombs, they should probably go back and watch those episodes. But what I assume people do know what an S-bomb is by now. And people who are watching this from your side of the world, like in your side of the world in the sense of the OT world, building S-bombs for a Python application or a Rust application is fairly straightforward. Doing that for the embedded world, very different problem space, right? I co-led one of the SysLink working groups for S-bomb generation with the guy from Lockheed, and they are now trying to figure out how to do S-bombs from like 30-year-old C code, right? And that's a very different problem. I'm sure you've seen something similar. Like, what have you seen there in people's journey to try to generate S-bombs for what generally we call legacy systems, right?
Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of more hands-on experience on that. I would be really interested in hearing what your experience on generating embedded S-bombs is. I think the first thing is that people start to realize that they need to do an S-bomb at all. Because it's the first time there really is a requirement to have an S-bomb. And a lot of discussions that I see are first based around, okay, we create that S-bomb. I mean, they're not obliged by the CRA to also share it with their customers. But of course, many customers would like to have it because they themselves are also CRA regulated. So if they use the product for using it into another product. So that's a big discussion with a lot of manufacturers saying, we don't want to share it because it doesn't even help you, because then you get the updates from us anyway about vulnerability. So why would we even share it? I would be interested in your opinion on that, actually. What's in there?
This is a conversation I've had many times, and a lot of people have very strong opinions either side, right? Is an S-bomb good to be shared publicly? The answer is it depends, right? And I think, to me, the reason why it's important to start with is it's a litmus test. Do you actually understand what goes into your software? I think that's a good starting point, right? And I think dealing with that in the legacy world is very, very difficult, right? But I think the sharing side of it is something that I will see if the appetite increases for it over time. I think we're going to have, you have the requirement, I believe you need to archive it for 5 years, I think, for every release, right?
I think 5, 10.
Yeah, 10 it's something probably. Like that.
Some so that years,
means that,
yes.
Yeah, but that means that regardless how you generated said S-bomb for your product, you still need to have a life cycle part of it, right? You need to build and store it somewhere. And I mean, we have just referenced the CISA sharing primer, which I'm sure you've read as well for S-bomb, the sharing primer that was written a few years ago. It's not a solved problem. People don't actually do it properly. Like, I've spoken with so many CISOs and they're like, yeah, I get some S-bombs. I chucked them into SharePoint and that's it. And so the life cycle of things is a problem that I'm passionate about, like trying to solve myself, because I think that's a big part. Like,
Also then the version management and the differences. So how do I quickly track the difference between an S-bomb from 5 years ago and 2 years ago?
And not only that, because what I discovered when we started doing S-bombs in the real world is that in a real product, you're not going to have one S-bomb. Like, you're going to have 10, 15 different S-bombs for different parts of your product, because a product is a composition of multiple components. And when you start to release things, you might use four of these, but this component changed. But the top level S-bomb is now different, right? So the release management is becoming much more difficult to do. And shame of self plug, that's what we saw with Spotify. But that's kind of the hard part, really, right? It's like how you do that scale, because if your top level obligation is that you need to provide an S-bomb for a product of a given version, you need to have, in 4 years from now, be able to say, oh, version 4.3.2 had these S-bombs, right? And that's the tricky part.
Yeah, and that also, I think that of course, there's a requirement to have an S-bomb, period. But in the end, just having an S-bomb doesn't help you at all, right? So you need to be able to do something with that. And yes, that's where a lot of conversation starts, also in the industrial sector, and I believe everywhere, because people say, okay, now if I have the last bomb, now what? Because when, if now a vulnerability comes up, I would expect my SPOM to quickly tell me, am I affected or am I not affected? But for that, you need not just an SPOM, you also need to be, need to have the vulnerability reporting in a format that actually corresponds to your SPOM format. Yeah. And that's also one of the big things we're talking about. So here, in at least in Europe and at, in the industrial space, the German BSI mm-hmm. also supports it. There's a lot of discussion about CISAF. So a machine-readable vulnerability sharing format. So where we say, okay, let's share vulnerabilities and security advisories in a way that is kind of standardized and machine-readable so that they can be tied into the SBOM mapping and all that thing. All those things can theoretically be done automatically because nobody wants to read all these vulnerability advisory PDFs and then try to make sense of that. So I think these are all the kinds of things. I mean, an SBOM is great, but you also need the entire ecosystem around that for it to work and not just be a giant data dump.
I think there's one even equally important point here, which is garbage in, garbage out, right? Like the quality of your SPOM ultimately determines how useful it is. And I think that's, a lot of people have gone through the motion to generate SPOMs just to tick the regulatory requirements. But I think, and actually I'm curious about your thoughts on that, because unlike, say, NTIA minimum element or CISA minimum element now that's in draft, the CRA doesn't explicitly state what the SBOM should look like, right? It doesn't, NTIA minimum element and CISA minimum, they go into very specific details. It should capture this data, it should capture this data, but CRA is much more vague on what that needs to capture, right?
They are thinking about, the European Commission is, on ENISA, actually thinking about releasing some more guidance on what it should look like, also because to achieve some kind of harmonization of how SBOMs look like across different products. There's currently actually a study carried out by ENISA requesting industry to submit, and all manufacturers in general to submit what they are currently doing regarding SBOMs and what their preferred formats are, things like that, in order to make sure that the guidance that they are drafting kind of reflects the reality and not has like the most cutting edge best ideas for SBOM that nobody can follow in reality, because that's really not what everybody is aiming at. Even the EU Commission isn't aiming at that. Sometimes we need to stress that. I really think if manufacturers are worried about unrealistic SBOM requirements, go to that study and participate and really have a, you don't have to shine there, just say what works for you and what doesn't work for you, because they're really trying to do that guidance in a way that actually reflects industry needs.
I mean, I think the CISA and NTIA minimum elements are pretty good, right? Because I think they are the gold standards as things stand right now. Are they hard to meet? Well, that exactly is what we tried to set out to test in the working group that we co-led, right? And the answer is yes, it is rather challenging to do it. It can be done, but it's rather challenging to do it. And again, coming back very much to what ecosystem are you in? Like doing it for a web app is very straightforward, relatively straightforward. Doing it for embedded C code, a lot more challenging, right?
That's the problem, because many of these things are always tested in like, okay, let's take just the most basic thing that we have and test it, and then it works fine. And then all the other product manufacturers come and say, well, but our product isn't that simple. So we don't have the standard web app. How about us?
Yeah. I mean, there are some, I mean, what I've seen, at least from the embedded world, there are some good things coming out of this. Conan, the package manager for C, is almost like a direct response to that. I mean, I'm sure it predates the whole CRA debate, but it's a good slot in way of bringing something that at least you can work with as a package rather than just a file you copy and run, which is traditionally speaking how a lot of embedded has been, right? Like you include this library that you had on some file share that is not even versioned, and how are you possibly going to do a CV scan about, I guess you could do static code analysis, but it gets a lot more murky, right?
No.
But it, what have you seen on that side? Like what, how, when you advising companies, I'd imagine a lot of them do have large legacy code bases, right? Much of it is, I would imagine, given OT being C code, I would imagine, right? How are they reacting to this? Like, are they like, oh, we got to solve this? Or like, are they trying to sit there and put their head in the sand and just try to ignore the problem altogether?
Well, they, at least what I can, what I see, there's always the prejudice that manufacturers are just sitting it out and not doing anything and things like that. At least that might be biased because people I work with obviously care about CRA and are aware of CRA, but all the manufacturers I see are really trying to take that seriously and also often trying to use it as a vehicle to improve on product cybersecurity, often furthering projects they've been trying to promote for years, and now they have a reason to do that. So, I mean, an SBOM isn't, if done right, I mean, it's not just a compliance thing to do, it's something that you do and then tick off the box and then file aside. But it's also something that really helps you doing software quality, doing version management, doing dependency management, all these things. So developers usually have an intrinsic motivation to do something like that because they want to get their code in order. So they're trying to find ways to do that, actually.
Yeah.
So that's okay.
No, I was just going to say, to me, an SBOM is just a good litmus test of what you know. Can you actually tell me what goes into your software? It might not be fully complete, and we all know that. Like, the cost of completeness in SBOM is, like, you can't measure completeness because that's an impossible thing to state that it's complete because how do you know?
CRA doesn't even say it needs to be complete. Just say, do your top-level dependencies at least. So
no transient dependencies are required at all?
No, it says, it explicitly says at least the top-level dependencies.
Okay.
I think to make it more doable for companies who are going at it the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me at least, it becomes a good, like, once you start generating these and you can start utility, then you can start using SBOM for like operational decisions, right? You get to a good way of expressing your posture, like CV being one of them, but also like other things like license audits. That's something that people should care about, right? Do I have some open source libraries that breaches my contractual obligation with my other things, right? That those are things now you can start doing. And that gets even more complicated in SBOM.
It's so often the case in cybersecurity that in order to do cybersecurity well, you do need to do all the quality things and the documentation things that shouldn't be cybersecurity's job, but they are because nobody did it before. And I think that's the same with SBOMs, and I see a lot of parallels in the entire risk assessment discussion that we're having around CRA, because that's kind of the same. Like for an SBOM, there are a lot of analogies there. You can do an SBOM just to check off the box, and then you have the SBOM and never look at it again, or you can use it to actually improve your decision-making. And it's the same with the risk assessment. The CRA says you need to do a risk assessment. You can just do a risk assessment, file it away, and never look at that thing again. That's probably going to be not the best experience. Or you can actually use it and see it as a tool and embrace it in order to do better and more informed decisions. And that's, I think, if there's one bottom line, if I should differentiate between manufacturers who are doing CRA compliance well and those who struggle, then that's really that mindset saying, okay, there are these things in the compliance, but I don't look at them for a compliance purpose, but I take them and try to use them for improving my security posture. And then the compliance just pops out in the end, because I think that's what the great thing about CRA is. There wasn't any critical debate on the requirements in CRA. It's like the wish list for every cybersecurity practitioner in the world. I mean, it's risk-based. There's an SBOM requirement. There's all the cybersecurity basics. There's vulnerability handling. So none of that is debatable, like from a common sense point of view. So you can really take all that and use that to better your cybersecurity posture and do it well and achieve CRA compliance on the way. That is entirely possible.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's very clear the direction we're heading, right? Like we SBOMs will come, at least if I were to hypothesize, a core requirement in almost any compliance framework going forward, right? Like CRA kind of leading the way. A PCI DSS 4.0 starts asking for software inventory, which is just SBOM codified, right? And I mean, I would be surprised if SOC 2, when the next update comes around, doesn't ask for SBOM. Same with ISO, right? I expect them to follow, right? And that becomes a universal litmus test in a way. But I think there are some
interesting... And also, I mean, if you have a software manufacturer who's not able to draw up an SBOM, then you should raise serious questions about how they actually code their software, right? So that's...
Yes, but it's kind of a software
quality thing as well. I totally understand. I have sympathy for everybody who hasn't done it yet because it just wasn't a requirement. It's kind of new. But every developer who strives to good quality code should get excited about that.
No, I guess my only comment on that is that sometimes you depend on other vendors who do not provide
that's
that.
True.
And that's where it's tricky. Like, you might want to do the best.
But then here's the great thing about CRA. All your vendors fall under CRA as well.
Yes,
They need to have an SBOM as well. And that's also one thing that I see currently in the industry. That's why I ask about sharing, your opinion on sharing SBOMs. Because people know that all manufacturers have to draw up the SBOM anyway. They start requesting it from their manufacturers in turn because they say, well, you're obliged to do that anyway, so why don't you share it with us? And there's always, I think CRA is also strengthened by the awareness of the of customers that certain things need to be done at the manufacturer so they can as well ask for that to be shared. That holds true for the SBOM, for risk assessment, for vulnerabilities, for all these kind of information that kind of people had to beg for and dig for in the past. And now it has to be there so it can as well be shared. And that's a real difference that I see.
Yeah, and I think let's go back to the sharing because I think there is more to unpack there because I think it's how you share it, right? I mean, you mentioned already, how much should you share? Because that's an open debate. Like, is it in the public? Is it gated? There are many ways to do sharing, right? But I think the one thing that I'm really excited about around sharing is how we automate that at scale, right? So I'm working with a project called Transparency Exchange API under Cyclone DX, where we try to standardize the way you discover SBOMs and security artifacts. And I think that's an interesting way of doing that. Because again, going back to, if you in turn depend on other companies that are part of your supply chain, you need to be able to discover their SBOMs in a programmatic way. You can't just go and say, oh, we just cut a new release, which requires a new version of this. Email me your SBOM. Like, it doesn't work. It needs to be an automated process that's fully like, oh, I'm requiring this version of your product. Now give me the SBOM for that version of that product, right?
And that's also one of the really smart things that the CRA does, I think, because they say, okay, a manufacturer is responsible for this entire product, including all components. So you're responsible for security of your products, including all the components. So you better make sure that the components that you have also meet certain cybersecurity standards. So that trickles down the entire supply chain. And that also holds true for open source components.
Yes.
And I think that's a tricky discussion because I think that's really at a crossroad here. So either it really strengthens the open source community because manufacturers are forced to contribute more, or it weakens the open source community because manufacturers say, whew, I can't take responsibility for that thing because it's open source. So I'm really curious looking what that is going to look like in the future.
That's a big can of worm that is probably worth its own episode, I think, because I think that is there's a lot to talk about there, right?
Because absolutely, I mean, yes,
it's completely unrealistic to expect that a one guy or girl library to have the same SLA for fixing things as a multinational, right?
But it's not required, right? The thing is, I think what the CRA does right is, I don't want to come across as a CRA fangirl, you know, but I'm just trying to take an optimistic view and to help people see the chances in that. What the CRA does right, I think, is that it, or the advantage or the big chance for the open source community is that it really brings that responsibility and accountability question into the open. Because currently what manufacturers often did is they just used the open source components because they were free, but they didn't really contribute anything. They didn't really take responsibility for the components we're using because everybody is using it, so we can use it like everybody else. And now the CRA just makes it very explicit who has the responsibility. And with that, manufacturers also need to decide how they live up to this responsibility. Do they commit to the open source project that they're using? Do they support it if they can't commit? That's also a way to do it. Do they support the ecosystem around that? Or do they say, okay, that's all much more expensive than building it ourselves? Well, then fine. Then obviously there wasn't a business case for the open source project. I mean, that's fine because it just brings all this that was implicit. It brings all of these conversations out in the open.
Yeah, I mean, I'm generally speaking optimistic about CRA. I think I'm not one for heavy regulation in general, but I think it's painstakingly clear the fact that security has been a market failure, right? If nothing will change, we will still have the same debate in 10 years about IoT device with default passwords getting compromised, or like nothing will change unless the regulatory pressure to change, right? So I'm not favor of doing heavy-handed regulation, but I'm also painstakingly obvious that something got to change for us to actually make a difference.
Me neither. And I think in an ideal world, we didn't need any of those.
Right.
So in an ideal world, we didn't need any law at all because people wouldn't murder each other, right?
Right.
So, but the problem is right now it's unfair because right now we have security regulation for critical infrastructures, for example. And they have this problem because they say that's also a lot of industrial sector. And they have this problem because they say, okay, well, we are supposed to take responsibility for the security of our critical infrastructure. And then we buy all these components that are a complete black box and we don't have any rights to claim anything from the vendors. And it's so hard to make them share information about cybersecurity and to live up to minimum standards and things like that. So I think it's a bit of putting a bit tilted version of regulation more upright because now manufacturers also have to do their part.
Yeah, and I mean, it definitely, I mean, I've dealt with a fair bit of manufacturers in China and so forth. And obviously, in particular, when you're buying software and hardware from there, the security attitude is very different as well. And I think that has put, generally speaking, a disadvantage for Western tech companies in general. In particular, if you look at baby cameras is a good example of something like that, like where it's usually like the cheapest one is the one who sells the most because people don't really, the average buyer can't tell the difference, right?
And security is so hard to communicate and so hard to grasp, right?
Yes, exactly. Like people are like, yes, I can see my baby on my phone. Problem solved. Can the rest of the world also do that? Yes, and that's the difference.
Yeah, and then there are also a lot of people who say, no, I don't use that baby cam on the phone at all because it sure is insecure. And that's also not great, finding like a middle ground where we say, okay, we make it transparent what kind of security should be there, so that is something that people that who care can request and can take a look at, and also some others that don't give a shit about security are just pushed out of the market. I don't think that's a bad thing, to be honest.
Yeah.
So I always had a lot of conversations with manufacturers saying, oh, now we're putting European manufacturers at a disadvantage, but that's not true. Actually, CRA puts them at an advantage because at least if they're holding up to higher security standards, because CRA doesn't just apply to European manufacturers, but to all manufacturers who sell to Europe.
Yeah. I mean, it all comes down to, at the end of the day, because I've had this conversation with a lot of people over the last few years, and it really comes down to, once this text is ratified in the context, I mean, Germany was one of the first ones to actually put their drafts together, right, for how actually the law is going to look like, which is not that surprising. But now, once we enter the actual time window for like where to enforce, and it's then going to come down to, will this actually be enforced? Because if it will not be enforced and there will not be any examples made out of this, then no vendor's going to actually care in then, right? And that's going to be the tricky part at the end. Like, will they care?
The good thing is that it's not just upon market surveillance authorities to enforce it, because I'm always, many manufacturers are currently asking me, okay, when are the market surveillance authorities knocking on our door and trying to probe products? And of course that can happen, but that's not the most likely case what they should be afraid of, because I think the much more likely case is that security researchers that's already been there, or also competitors of these manufacturers, take the product support and file non-conformity claims at the market surveillance authorities, and then they need to go after that. So it's really all the things that security researchers have done for ages anyway, they now have something to, like a tool to say, okay, if they really find something that puts the product at non-conformity with the CRA, there's actually a tool for market authorities to force market authorities to go after that. Yeah. And this is like the hardest penalty you can give to any manufacturers, that they can't sell their products anymore. I've also heard people saying, hey, but the fines are not high enough. But it's not about the fines. It's about not being able to place a product on the market. That's that's the highest fine you can get.
Yeah, I guess my worry, I guess, is some extent, which is voiced by it, is like, is this going to get stuck in like court for 5 years before we see the first actual verdict? And then nothing is going to happen in those in the in between, I guess. Like, I guess there are lost. There's a lot of parallels with GDPR, right?
Could happen, yes. But then at least you got to start somewhere. So you better start these 5 years of doing nothing now.
That's fair enough. The last thing I wanted to kind of like wrap up here about is talking about like communicating vulnerabilities, because that's a big part of the CRA. It's like, how do you communicate vulnerabilities? And there are, I mean, anybody who works in cybersecurity are familiar with like the CVE process and how that works, as flawed or it may or may not be. That's a different debate altogether. But communicating that both to consumers and the EU side of that, like, walk me through the requirements for the CVE side of ECRA. Like, how does that look like? What does it look like for a manufacturer who's bringing something to market? Like, what does that look like? Because the CVE process is very different, or can be fitted in, I suppose, but most vendors are not familiar with the CVE management side of things.
So what does the vulnerability communication look like? Is that your question?
My question is more like, if you're a manufacturer selling it to the market, and if you're a small manufacturer, you have probably never had to dealt with CVEs, right? Or you probably dealt with them in your supply chain, but you've never been had CVEs issued against you, so you are not familiar with the process around that. Mm. When you're entering the market,
responsible disclosure and all these kind of things.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
So, I mean, what they have to do is, there's always, I think there's one basic distinction that people need to be aware of. It's a bit, it's worded not that great in the CRA. I think there are exploitable vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. These are like the things that must not be in your product. And if an exploitable vulnerability is in your product, then you must stop selling it. Mm-hmm. And then there are the actively exploited vulnerabilities. And this really is more like a security incident. So it's really something has happened to your product. So somebody has actually exploited something. So it's not just a vulnerability. It's more like really a insecurity incident. And for the latter, manufacturers have to report them actually to authorities, to ENISA and to the national CSERTs or national CERTs. And for the former, they have to scan for all vulnerabilities, and first they have to find out which of those are exploitable, which is kind of a term that manufacturers can somehow shape themselves. So they must decide what is counts as exploitable for their products under circumstances. And for those, that's basically the normal responsible disclosure and also the normal vulnerability handling process that people know that people use. I don't think there's big changes in there. So you need to have a fix or a patch. You need to communicate to your customers. You need to have security advisories, all these kind of things. And you also have to have kind of a contact point where people can approach you about vulnerabilities. That's the responsible disclosure. And I think if manufacturers haven't had any vulnerability management process before, then probably the hardest part is really establishing a process to efficiently work down your way of the big pile of vulnerabilities that's going to come up if you start doing that. So that probably is the most difficult thing to do in the beginning.
As someone who runs vulnerability programs, I think a lot of people underestimate the workload that comes from managing a vulnerability program with responsible disclosures, in particular now in the day of AI. I mean, I can see one of my colleagues with ScreenLink, we get so many vulnerability disclosures every day, right?
Okay, and you need to deal with all of those.
The problem is the signal-to-noise ratio, right?
Yeah.
Because, yes, you might get 100 reports and 99% of them are just AI filings, essentially, but there might be a super severe one on the one, right?
Exactly what I mean. So like an efficient mechanism for getting this big pile of information down to what actually matters. So I think that's the biggest challenge in there. Because, I mean, the formal reporting, well, fine, there's a reporting for a reporting portal going to be, and you need to file a report there. That's fine. So that's all things that are doable. But really managing this influx of information, that's the hardest part, I think.
The triaging is the hard part, right? Finding signals and noise, that's the hard part.
Finding a way to actually, I think, an efficient way to define for yourself what an exploitable vulnerability is. So that and making that decision to what needs to be patched and what doesn't, and then communicating that well.
Yes.
I'm hoping that we're getting good industry standards so that people say, okay, like this is how you actually how actually customers want to see vulnerability information and advisories, so that we get somehow a standard. I've seen many people, or I think CISA also does it, using MITRE ATT&CK, for example, saying, okay, this refers to these MITRE ATT&CK techniques, and this is what we recommend you to do. So any kind of structure that is reproducible, I think that would really help.
Yeah, I think that there is a push right now for kind of a more global, non-US centric view of CV publishing, right? Because that's been kind of, in particular with, well, I don't know where we stand right now with the CISA vulnerability databases and where, but yeah, like nonetheless, like having a global one that is non-US centric is probably a healthy balance, I guess, as well.
The European Union has also, NISA has also published its own EUVD. It's not really a known database, but it's an own display of the information, right? So they're not collecting their own information. But that again, that is not the most important part. Being similar to managing vulnerabilities, it's not hard to write a software to put them in a beautiful table. It's hard to find a way to actually manage that and find a process to manage that. And at the same time, I think that's what's behind the CVE database. That really is all the work is collecting all these vulnerabilities and writing the advisories and filling the database meaningfully. And I think that is still unanswered. Who's going to do that?
Yeah. And I can tell you firsthand, working with like both project like OSV from Google and Dependency Track from CycloneDX, the problem is you will have false positives, right? Because they are not super clean data sets, and you will have duplicate names. Like I can give you an example. We had a high alert firing like that a week, saying like, oh, super high vulnerability. And then you're like, on this package. And you're like, well, we're using this package, but it's in a completely different ecosystem. It just happens to have the same name. It's just like this vulnerability was for like a Java package and we had like a Python package, but like they had the same name.
Isn't that something that AI could somehow solve? I mean, finding duplicates or something like that?
You would think. Maybe we'll get there one day. But I mean, at least people started using them more and more, right? And that's going to help building up these tools and make them better and making the data sets better and more useful. So no, hopefully we're in a better place in a year from now, and when things are starting to shape up. So, Sarah, we're coming up at the top of the hour here. What would you like to say to people that are getting into this? Like last final words for people who are looking into getting their CRA cards sorted. Any final words of where they need to, get in touch with you, or what's your one advice?
Well, what I always advise them to take as one of the first steps is to find their showstoppers in their products, because product life cycles, development life cycles take a long time. And it really makes sense to right in the beginning really run your products high level through the CRA requirements. Don't wait for any harmonized standard. Take the CRA requirements and see where you might have major showstoppers and work on those, because these are the things that are going to take time. And then second, start doing the risk assessment, because that really is the linchpin in CRA that you need to make all decisions. And if you start with those two things quickly, plus the vulnerability handling, then the rest will fall into place. I think.
Wise words. Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you for coming on the show. Have a good one. Cheers.
Thank you for having me. It was